Thank you, David. So it's a pleasure to be here. As David is saying, I'm straight off the plane. I arrived yesterday, caught a cold in the plane, so I hope you will pardon my voice. I don't know if the artist in residence can improve that, but I think aspirin will be better for this. So it's a pleasure to give the pending talk to the one that Marcek gave at the beginning of this. As Marcek was telling me, I gave the opening speech, you will give the one closing up the joint, essentially. So I'll try to stay in the continuity of what he said and tell you a little bit more on this fantastic field of cold atoms that I'm sure you've been familiar with in the course of the program. I could restate the title as Dreams and Realities. In cold atoms. I'm writing a little bit more, so I hope there is no problem for the people. If there are, just let me know and I'll try to increase the size of the writing. Okay, so before I start on the measurement part, as David said, I want to talk about measurement, but I think I need to remind you some of the basic things about cold atoms. After all, you were not all there at the talk of Marcek. So I think I want to remind you what is the goal of the business with cold atoms. And so I want to start with something which I would call flexibility and control. So what is the basic idea that people had when they wanted to use cold atoms to try to emulate condensed matter physics? So let's start with the basic ideas. So the basic idea is that you can have, in a cold atom system, you can trap in lasers essentially particles which will become which are bosons or fermions, and in addition to trapping them, you can use light to shape potentials in which you will put the atoms. So I'm sure you heard previously that you can put a periodic potential by using two counter-propagating lasers. And essentially, atoms will be attracted or repelled by the laser, which means that they will have preferred places in space where they would like to sit. And of course, you have realized when you do something that way, you have realized the fake crystal where the periodic potential is not imposed by the ions in the crystal, but is imposed by the laser power. So why is it interesting? Well, it's interesting because you still get quantum particles, and so you have particles which are able to tunnel from one of the site to the next site, which means that by controlling the power of the laser, you're able to control the overlap between the particle in this site and this site, so you're able to engineer what is known in the literature as a tight binding Hamiltonian, where essentially you represent on the lattice kinetic energy, so I just write it that way, C dagger I Cj, which says that you are able to destroy a particle on site J and create it, recreate it on site I with an overlap which is given by the tunneling matrix element here in the potential. Now, in condensed matter, this is something which is sort of the basics of representing electrons propagating in a solid, where of course the periodic potential is the periodic potential due to the ions in the solid, and for which you usually have no particular well-defined expression, and it's a major problem to compute even this band structure or to compute this simple matrix element here, which is the tunneling matrix element. So here in the cold atom physics, you can realize a very nice simplistic situation where you can control perfectly this tunneling matrix element. It's quite funny because if you look at most of the books in condensed matter physics, the expression which is given in them to compute the tunneling matrix element is simply wrong. It's completely wrong because nobody uses it. They just give you the expression and then they simply say, oh, but it's complicated to compute, so let's take it as a parameter. Well, in cold atoms you can compute it, and if you try to do it, it's quite involved, but you can actually do it. So you have an Hamiltonian where you can control very well the kinetic energy, and you have another advantage, is that normally in condensed matter physics, the interaction between particles is of course the interaction between electrons, which is the Coulomb interaction. And in a solid, the Coulomb interaction you could think is long range, but in fact, because of the screening, because of the fact that you have a metal, it turns out to be relatively short range. If you put numbers, you find that the screening radius of the Coulomb interaction in a solid is typically the interatomic spacing, so a couple of angstroms. So it's an extremely short range interaction, but nevertheless, it's an approximation to assume that you get a short range interaction between two electrons. But it's a good approximation. So as a result, theorists who try to model solids are very often use models, and we will write one of them, where instead of taking the long-range Coulomb interaction and adding the screening on the top of it and summing diagrams after diagrams, I've started from the beginning with the short-range interactions. But these models are usually approximations. And in complicated situations, where such as high TC superconductors, just to name one, essentially people are killing each other to know whether when they solve such a simplified model, the physics they get is a result of the approximation they use on the model or is contained in the realistic compound that they are trying to solve. So here there is the fantastic idea that one can realize in these systems this very simple model with short-range interactions. The idea is very simple. The atoms are neutral, so they simply don't see each other if they are on two different sides of the lattice, but they will experience a repulsion if you put the two atoms in the same well. Then essentially the atom will feel their scattering and therefore will pay some energy. So as a result, you are realizing something which is not an approximation, but which is the real description of your atomic system when you put a short-range repulsion here, which says that if you have zero atom, you're not paying a price U. If you have one atom, you're not paying a price U. But starting with two and more atoms, you're paying an energy U if you try to put more than one atom on a well. So this type of Hamiltonian is known as the Hubbard model. For fermions, it was introduced in 1963 by Hubbard. For bosons, sometimes it's called the Bose-Hubbard model, and there is a very beautiful paper by Matthew Fisher with using the Bose-Hubbard model to describe a certain number of transition for bosonic systems. But this is really, I think one can say, it's the Ising model of strong correlations. It's the simplest model that contains all the ingredients you want to have when you have particle moving on the lattice, namely band structure, band filling, and interaction. So this is really something you want to solve, and we'll come back on whether it's solvable or not, but essentially this is really an important model for which we would like to understand the physics. So the idea is that cold atoms can provide a good realization of this Hubbard or Bose-Hubbard model, because again, the atoms are neutral, and that's very important to get the short-range interaction, and the potential here is very well controlled. I just want to add that in addition of controlling the strength of the kinetic energy, so T is controlled by the optical lattice, because if I make the optical lattice larger, then I will reduce the amplitude of the hopping. And it was realized in a very nice paper by Peter Zoller and his group that indeed such system would constitute a fantastic laboratory to tackle phase transitions where you can vary the ratio between the interaction energy and the kinetic energy. You see that this Hamiltonian has only one parameter, which is the ratio between U and T. And by controlling the optical lattice, you can change the ratio U over T, and you can scan the various phases that are available in the system. Well, this has a drawback, which is that if you make T too small, then you have other energies in the problem, such as the temperature, that play a role. So you would like to be able to control independently U and T. To make a long story short, this is also possible using a trick known as the Feshbach resonance, where you directly change the scattering between two atoms. So just to say, and again, I'm not going into details because you can look at the video of Marček for this part of the physics, but essentially U is also can also be controlled. So now you have a fantastic system where essentially you can control the kinetic energy, you can control the interaction, because you have a crystal made of light. You can also control the dimensionality of the problem. So for example, if you have two lasers like this, you will create a lattice in two directions, but nothing in the third direction. So you will realize one-dimensional system, which is one of the reasons why I started being interested in cold atoms. I'm kind of obsessed with one-dimensional systems. So essentially, you have realizing tubes. So it's a fantastic way to control the dimension. If I just put one pair of counter-propagating lasers, you will realize pancakes, and you will realize two-dimensional systems. So here is one of the things you can do. You can also add perturbation in a very controlled way. For example, disorder, because you can use again the property of lasers on a speckle. You know, when you shine your laser, you see all these little grains of light, which are the results of the laser. So you can add on the top of this very nice system, you can add disorder in a controlled way. So it looks like a fantastic type of system where you can realize quantum simulators for, and I would say, condensed matter, and I put it in quote, because this would be a simplistic view. I would say strong correlations in general. What is the idea? The idea is that you have a model, an experimental realization of something which is described by a model you control totally, for which you know this parameter, you know this parameter, and so you can do an experiment and measure directly on the experiment the answer that you're trying to have for this given model. Okay. Of course, you could say, and especially in view of the other program, the program on numerical simulation, why not do it with a computer? And there, the reason is very simple. For bosons, there are extremely efficient techniques to simulate bosonic systems. And I'm sure you heard several talks on that. This is true, of course, if you're dealing with thermodynamic, static systems, non-disordered systems to some extent. For fermions, there is still a major problem, which is that it's practically impossible at the moment to make large-scale simulations on large systems of fermions. So the idea is that maybe using these experimental systems, one can have a direct, let's say, observation, but on such a simple model that will give us the answer that we search. For example, is the Hubbard model something that has superconductivity at a reasonable temperature? Whether this is the solution of high TC will, of course, depend on the answer on this question. numerical simulation for the moment have failed to answer this question. There was a very beautiful talk in this very room 1 year ago by Matthias Troyer, where he compared several results of several groups on this issue. And so the idea would be, let's do an experiment with the cold atoms and measure directly if there is transition to a superconducting state at a given temperature, and therefore we will know what is the answer. So there was a kind of search or burst of activity to try to use the cold atoms as quantum simulators. I just want to make them justice and say that in addition of that, they also provided a wealth of novel physical phenomena. And I think it's something that people in condensed matter should look at, because there were situations that were realized in cold atoms. For example, you have the possibility to switch on the interaction and suddenly switch it off. So make the transition between a state which would be a Mott insulator, something which is driven by the interaction, to a simple superfluid state. And of course, it's not easy to realize in condensed matter. You cannot just switch off the lattice potential, or you cannot just switch off the interaction. But it opened the way, in particular, to a lot of out-of-equilibrium physics. And we could, I'm sure, take the lessons that were learned from this type of system and see whether we can do something. I just want to mention something which I find particularly interesting. Of course, here you can realize whatever you want. In particular, you can also control the statistics. Because if you take certain type of atoms, you will get bosons. If you take another type of atoms, you will get fermions. You can even get mixtures. And you can also realize things which are not so easy to obtain in condensed matter, like bosons with spin 1/2. Of course, it doesn't mean that there is a genuine spin 1/2. It would violate profound theorems. But it means bosons with two colors. And in fact, there is really novel physics. We have been playing a little bit with that with Misha Zvonarev, and more recently with Adrian Cantillon. And you can get phases which are quite surprising out of, for example, bosons with internal degrees of freedom. And so on. And I think it would be interesting in condensed matter to take this physics and see whether we could realize it. Okay, but anyway, people have tried to use this and essentially get quantum simulators, and they were, I think, pretty good success. Just to quote a few, it depends, of course, who you are. But I think, for example, the results that were obtained on Anderson localization using either disordered potential or bichromatic potential, both in the group of Alain Aspect, for example, and in the group of Massimo Inguccio, were pretty interesting results, which potentially will open the way to situations for which really novel physics can be obtained. There are also very interesting results that were obtained on interacting one-dimensional bosons. And of course, people are working very, very hard with fermions to obtain the solution of the 2D Hubbard model. But for reasons that I will explain, there are some problems in going to this direction. So that's essentially the idea, which is that one wants really to use these systems as quantum simulators. Now, beyond these basic ideas, I would say, what are the limitations? They are of several kinds. The first one is that the quantum simulator is not perfect. So let's call it the imperfections of the quantum simulator. The first that comes to mind is simply the number of particles, the finite number of particles. You load the lattice with whatever, 10,000 bosons, 50,000 bosons, it doesn't matter. Something like this. Now, in fact, if it was just this, this would be a perfect quantum simulator. I'm sure everybody who is doing numerical simulation would agree with me that if you do a numerical simulation on a 10 by 10 or a 20 by 20 system, you're already pretty happy that you have reached thermodynamic limit. Or let me say that way, I see my friend Didier smiling. He has done a lot of work using exact diagonalization, which is essentially 4 by 4 systems, and you can extract very, very useful results out of it. So the size itself of the simulator is not a major problem. There are enough bosons to reach sizes that would put out of work everybody doing real numerical calculations. But I just quoted that the size, but it's not really a limitation. Much more dramatic is the inhomogeneities. What I mean by that is that, of course, experiments are not done in zero gravity, and the cold atoms need to be held in place by something. And in fact, they are held in place by a potential that is essentially growing as you move away from the center of the trap, where this object is something that is growing as R squared, so some parabolic confining potential. So it doesn't sound much, but what it means, and I'll do it in one dimension because I don't know how to do it otherwise, it means that your atoms are trapped in such a parabola, which means that if you look at the density as a function to the distance of the trap, it's of course not homogeneous. So if you don't have strong interactions, people have used approximation, so-called Thomas Fermi approximation and so on, to tell you that essentially you get something which is a kind of inverted parabola. My artistic skills are not up to the task, I'm sorry. You get some inverted parabola. But what you want to study are phenomena which are strongly dependent on the density of particles, like, for example, Mott transitions. Mott transition is something which tells you that, for example, if you look at the chemical potential versus one over interaction, you will get phases like this, where you get here one particle per site, here, let's say, two particle per site, and so on, which means that if you're here, the number of particles will jump discontinuously as the chemical potential is varied. So if you look at the density profiles, you will get something which would be one particle, two particle, and which can do something like this. People have called this the wedding cake structure. It's quite imaged. And it means simply that if you look at this part of the system, you will see a phase which has, let's say, between one and two particles, so it will be a superfluid. If you look here, you will see a phase which has one particle per site, so it will be a Mott insulator. And if you look here, you will see a phase which has between one and zero particle per site, so it will again be a superfluid. And if you make a measurement, and now we are approaching the measurement question, if you make a measurement on such a system, you're essentially having an average answer. And it's extremely difficult to understand what is the physics of such system, because what you're seeing is a kind of average between a superfluid, a Mott insulator, and again a superfluid, but with different densities. So it's not so much that your system is finite size, which is causing a problem, but it's the fact that your system is inhomogeneous, and we are not equipped, I would say, in our knowledge or use of of condensed matter systems to deal with strongly inhomogeneous systems. We are more used into thinking in terms of critical phenomena, where we have a divergent correlation length that become very large, but implicitly assuming the system is keeping, you know, all the parameters constant. So this is causing a very severe problem, and the people doing numerical simulation usually, when they have a finite size, take great care that their system is homogeneous, either by taking periodic boundary conditions or by taking a square box so that the effect of the surface is reduced to a minimum. Here, we have a kind of surface which is everywhere in the system. So there are two attitudes with respect to that. One is to say, well, let's simulate the system and put by hand the inhomogeneities in the simulations. Then we get an average result from the simulation, and we compare the result with the result of the experiment. Usually, it completely obscures the physics. It's just that if you take a numerical simulation with the same ingredient than the experiment, and you do your simulation correctly, you do your experiment correctly, the two results agree, but it's very hard to understand what is behind it. And of course, we go back to the fact that if you want to deal with fermion problem, you don't really have something good to do the simulation, because otherwise you wouldn't spend time with the cold atoms in the first place. So the inhomogeneities are really, in my opinion, one of the major problems that one has to deal with. I just want to only put the blame on the inhomogeneities. They also have some advantage, because, for example, if you want to realize a phase which has one boson per site and you don't have the inhomogeneities, you have to control very precisely the number of bosons you will put in your system. Because of the confining potential, you don't need to care. You just throw in a bunch of bosons, and they will sort of self-arrange and give you this insulating phase. So they also play a good role, but you would like to be able to disentangle the physics coming from this region from the physics coming from this region from the physics coming from this region. And now we're approaching one of the important part of this business, which is you want to be able to probe the results that you obtain in this cold atom experiment in a way that allow you to access the physics that you really want to. I just want to mention another limitation, which is a very severe limitation, but I won't talk about it, which is the temperature. Because you hear about cold atoms, but in fact, they are mostly, okay, temperature is nanokelvin, but again, when you deal with a quantum problem, you always have to compare the temperature to some internal energy scale of the problem. When one is dealing with bosons, the temperature is very low or reasonably low. So experiments done with bosons are really deep in the quantum regime. And that is why they, I think, have obtained pretty spectacular results. For the fermions, for the moment, people are at the edge. And the reason is that although the temperature is nanokelvin, when you put it in the scale of the Fermi temperature, what you get is that the temperature is, if you don't have the optical lattice, is of the order of T Fermi divided by 20, about that. I mean, people can perhaps give me more precise numbers, but it's about T Fermi divided by 20, which is pretty cold. But if you convert it in condensed matter number, T Fermi is typically 1 electron volt, 12,000 Kelvin. So if you divide it by 20, what you get is essentially 600 Kelvin, which is still twice the room temperature. And you know, most experiments are done at the Kelvin or 10 Kelvin or so. If you're on the optical lattice, what you get is more T Fermi over 6. So you're still doing, quote, experiments at the nanokelvin, but at an energy scale of 2,000 Kelvin, if I want to convert it in condensed matter. So there is a huge challenge, and I'm sure this challenge will be met. Again, one has to keep in mind that this is a field which is essentially 10 years or maybe 15 years old, and it has known incredible progress. But I just want to mention that at the moment, the temperature is of the order of, quote, 2,000 Kelvin in condensed matter. So people have observed with fermions the MOT phase, the insulating phase driven by interactions, but they are trying to get to lower and lower temperature to observe other phenomena like antiferromagnetism that we are used to in condensed matter simply because our room temperature is naturally much lower than the temperature of antiferromagnetism, which is of the order of the 1,000 Kelvin. So there is a huge challenge here, but I'm sure this challenge will be met. There are several proposals on how to cool. This is how to invent a cooling, efficient cooling system for these problems. Okay, I just want to now move to the crux of the matter, which are the probes. Okay, when I started the talk, I sort of said, you know, all the troubles in condensed matter come from the fact that we have the Coulomb interaction. It's long range, it's a disaster. Life would be much nicer if it was short range and so on. But again, the Coulomb interaction is a blessing. The blessing is that the electron is charged. So in condensed matter, we can probe the system in many, many ways simply because we can manipulate the electron. If you put an electric field, you directly act on the current and you're measuring the conductivity, which is nothing but the current-current correlation function. If you're doing X-rays, you see essentially the structure of the system and you can decide about, for example, density-density correlation function. So we can probe the density-density correlation functions. I don't know, X-rays, for example. If you're doing neutrons, you can probe the spin of the system. So we have zillions of probes which are using the fact that the electrons and the particles in the system are charged. And for example, one control parameter that we have is magnetic field. Magnetic field allows you to probe magnetoresistance, Hall effect, and so on and so forth. And so we are used to, in condensed matter, to have all these probes. There is another probe that people know as ARPES, angle resolved photoemission, which consists in sending photons on the system, extracting one electron out of the system, then you measure the momentum K and the energy of the particle that has been extracted, and out of this you reconstruct what is the distribution of the momentum and energy of the particle inside the system. So for example, you have extracted this guy here, so you can get the probability of having an excitation with a momentum K and a frequency and energy omega. Okay. Now, you want to do the same thing with cold atoms. And there, naively, you start running into a lot of problems. And the problems is that the atoms are neutral, which is great, because this is what allows you to use them as quantum simulator in the first place, but which is not so great, because you want to do a conductivity experiment. How do you do? You want to measure the density-density correlation function. How do you do? And so on and so forth. So we are having here a field which is desperately in need of probes, because otherwise it's very nice to be able to simulate something. But you know, it's like the write-only memory. You know, you have all types of memory, and some people wanted to invent the write-only memory, which is a memory in which you can only write, but you can never read, which is of very limited use, okay? So here, we don't want to have the write-only memory, so we need to be able to probe the system. And of course, the domain, the field of cold atom reacted to this demand, reacted to this new physics that was prompting to be discovered from strong correlations by inventing, by thinking in terms of new probes. And I just would like to flash one or two examples. I think I have about 20 minutes or so, to flash one or two examples of probes that people have developed in response of this demand. So I would like to start, if my voice let me do it, by spectroscopy. Okay. So, you know, this is something that comes from atomic physics, so people here in this field have a lot of habit in measuring transitions between, you know, various levels and things like this, but it doesn't really help you to know if a system is an insulator or a metal or something like this. So you have to use this knowledge of spectroscopy to connect to things that people in condensed matter were used to, which are correlations. And I think this was one of the interesting evolution of these two communities getting together. And if there is one message you have to retain from this blackboard talk, is that cold atoms are fantastic systems, not only because they can be used as quantum simulators, but because they offer a different window on the same phenomena. There are things that are incredibly easy to do in condensed matter and incredibly difficult to do with cold atoms, and vice versa. And I'll try, of course, to insist on such examples. And that's, in my opinion, something really nice, because you can really access the same phenomenon by several edges. So the first probe that people used was the so-called time of flight. That's the method by which Bose-Einstein condensation was observed. And the idea is very simple. You just have your system here. I will cheat you shamelessly by describing the methods. So the specialist, don't tell. But okay, I'll try to be half honest. Okay, so what is the idea? You take your system, which is confined by the lasers, and then suddenly you let go. If you let go, the system expands. And you have to assume that when it expands, nothing bad is really taking place in the initial stage, so that after a while, it has grown a little bit, but because it's very dilute gas, the interactions are now essentially zero, because the particles are so diluted that they don't see each other, which means that the later stage of the expansion, the ball drops, but forget the fact that it drops. Just imagine it expands. Let's switch off gravity by hand. Well, you have a certain gas here that will expand, and it expands, of course, based on the laws of free particles, which means that if you have a particle which has a certain momentum k at a certain position, then it will just propagate like a free particle and move to another position. So you can easily conceive that the higher momentum k you have in your system, the faster the ball will expand. And so this is the idea behind this technique. You just let the system expand, and after a while, you just shine a laser, and you take an image of the ball, and you get here a density profile. The particles which are at the edge are the ones which had a very large velocity, which could escape very far from the center. So they correspond to large momenta. The particle which stays in the middle means that they had no velocity, no momenta. And so by measuring here this density profile rho of x, you can directly relate it to the momentum distribution, the n of k, inside the system. So this is the final state, and this is the initial state. So you have a way, provided you let the ball expand enough, and enough, how long is enough, is something which is to be determined. There are very beautiful comparison between experiments in the group of Emmanuel Bloch and calculations, for example, in the group of Matthias, to decide how precise is this comparison. But the basic idea that by simply measuring the density profile of the expanded cloud, you access inside the system the momentum distribution of your system. So for example, if you measure this, you can say, oh, I have a normal gas. Or if I am looking at n of k, I have, on the contrary, because I find the peak at k equals 0, I have, on the contrary, a Bose-Einstein condensate. So this is one of the first probes that was used in this system, and that's still probably the most easy and the most used probes. It can be perfected a little bit from this simple vision, and I won't enter too much into the details because this is something which is a little bit complicated, but essentially due to an idea by Ehud Altman and Eugene Demmler, which is to say that if I look at this image and I repeat the experiment many times, I will see my density profile. But in fact, my image has peaks and dents in the density profile, because my initial distribution is, in fact, inside the system correlated. There are correlations in the system here that will traduce by the fact that there are correlations that will occur in the density profile. For example, if I have a pair, k minus k, every time I find a particle here, I will find a particle on the other side. and I can average, but I will always find this correlation. So by repeating these measurements, but instead of measuring the average quantity, measuring the noise on the image, you can access the average of n of k prime. Okay, I just put it in quote, just to. So you can access the correlations that exist between the various distribution of momenta inside the system. Okay, so that's one type of measure. A type of measure which is related to that and which was very, very useful was interferences. Okay, so what is the idea? The idea here is that you take a system which is here, and then you let it propagate as a free particle, and it arrives here, and what you say, oh, here I had a wave function, so if I measure psi of x, it's the sum over decay of psi of k exponential of I kx, but it had to propagate, so I have to put the time dependence, and if it propagates with free propagation, it's h bar square k square over 2m times t, okay? And probably an h bar here if I want to be homogeneous, so let me remove this. And now you see that if you want to avoid interferences, you can say that you have a optimal k, which is just giving a stationary phase here that you obtain by saying that x is equal to k divided by m h bar times t, which is exactly the relations that I was advocating here, that you see that if you measure the density of particle at point x, it corresponds inside your system to an initial momentum k that is given by this relation. In other words, the only particle that arrive here are the one that were with a precise momentum k in the initial step. But instead of doing that with one object, you can do it with two objects. So imagine I have two tubes like the one I was mentioning here, and that I am letting the tube expand. I will get particles that will go up to there, particles that will go up to there, and these two particles will add each other. In other words, what I will see is an interference between these two tubes. And again, to cut a long story short, this is a method that was proposed by Polkovnikov, Altman, and Demmler, same essentially idea, is the fact that if you measure, again, shine a laser in this direction and measure the interference pattern that is taking place as a function of this coordinate, let me call it x, what you will access is something which is very interesting, which is the integral from 0 to L of dz of the correlations A of z, A dagger of 0, inside one of these objects. Because you can understand that if the phase of the system is constant along the tube here, essentially you will add coherently all these points to produce one, whatever, positive or negative interference here. But if the phase change a lot here along the tube, then the part will cancel and you will see a gray area in between the tubes. So this is a very nice way, because it's a very easy experiment to do, to access single particle correlation inside the system. And it's particularly interesting if you want to deal with one-dimensional physics, because in one dimension, these objects are supposed to behave as Paulos, which means that this thing is supposed to behave as a Paulo of the length of the tube with a certain exponent. So you can start using it to probe, for example, for Luttinger liquid physics. And this is something that has been done. So you start seeing how inventing probes or having good probes now gives you access to interesting new phenomena. This was also used by the group at the École Normale, Jean Dalibard and collaborator, to probe for Berezinski costless Stauless physics in 2D, because if you are in the low temperature phase, this varies as Paulo, so this is a Paulo of the size of the pancake, On the contrary, if you're in the high temperature phase, this varies exponentially and you get a completely different dependence. So these are two very useful probes that people have used. Do we have something that looks like the X-rays? Again, I will cut a long story short, but this is being developed. And this is something which is called Bragg spectroscopy. And the idea is the following. Again, I'm sort of cheating shamelessly in the details, but imagine you have your system here. Now you send two lasers, and you can slightly offset one of the laser, tilt the angle here. You don't put the lasers with the same frequency, omega 1, and you put here omega 2. If you do this, you can make transitions by absorbing omega 1, absorbing or re-emitting, if you prefer, omega 2. And it's like if you did a transition with omega 1 minus omega 2. So you can induce, by using a third state, which is called a Raman process, you can induce transition between two internal states of the system at a frequency, which is the difference of frequency between the two lasers. If you want, you can view it as your system absorbing two photons, whose energy will be the difference of the two energies. Now, they absorb two photons, so they also absorb the momenta of the two photons, which, if you choose your angle right, will be a certain wave momentum h bar q. So what you have done, you have made your system absorb something with a momentum h bar q and a certain frequency omega. And what you can check is that every particle which was with momentum k is now shifted to k plus q. So if you prefer, what you've done is a transition ck plus q ck, and you did it for all the particles in the system, which is the sum over k, which is nothing but the Fourier transform of the density rho of q. So this procedure, if you measure the energy absorbed, which again by Fermi golden rule is given by the square of the matrix elements, blah, 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 is nothing but something measuring the density-density correlation function. And people have started using this. There are very beautiful experiments on that. So this is something giving you access to the density-density correlation function. So we are slowly starting to feel, or if I can say, or catalog of probes that exist in condensed matter, but these are recent things. For example, the Bragg spectroscopy has been used, there are very recent experiments, it has been used long time ago, but there are very recent experiments in the group of Massimo Inguccio. This is 2009. I mean, this is really things which are now being carefully implemented to probe MOT physics, but these are really recent things. Okay, now let's continue our tour of probes, and I just want to take one probe. So I won't discuss ARPES. There is a very beautiful way to implement ARPES using also Raman scattering. This was done experimentally in the group of Deb Jean in Boulder. This was also done theoretically by the groups of Antoine Georges, Christophe Salomon in Paris. I won't have time to discuss it, but I just want to mention that one can do ARPES, again, using Raman scattering. I just want to show you how one can do, essentially, conductivity. So let me, this is four. So let me take a probe, which I will call the shaking, because I think it's a good example on how cold atoms themselves can suggest new probes to which people had not thought in condensed matter. You have an optical lattice, like this, and you don't know what to do on your system. Well, what do? You change the amplitude of the optical lattice, and you modulate it with time. So you say V plus delta V cosine omega 0 t times cosine qx. Now you do this for a while, you shake your system, you measure the energy absorbed by measuring the final temperature of the system, and then you try to plot the energy absorbed as a function of the frequency omega zero at which you've done your probe, and you find, this was done in the group of Tillmann, Esslinger in Zurich, and you find several series of peaks here. Or you find a big potato here. And now you wonder, what did you learn here? Which was not so easy. And this is something we studied with various collaborators, Anibal Yucci, Miguel Casalella, Andrew Ho, and then Corinna Collat and the group of Uli Schoelwöck. And one can reasonably understand what is measured in two different limits. If you're doing a weak modulation, if the amplitude is weak, well, you get a potential which is coupling to the density, so you would say, oh, I do linear response, and I'm measuring again the density-density correlation. So that's a way to probe this. But if the lattice is strong, this is completely wrong. If the lattice is strong, what happens? You're having a lattice like this, and now you're changing the amplitude. So the main effect is to change the barrier. So what you're modulating is the kinetic energy between the sites. And what you're probing in this limit is the kinetic energy correlation. And once you have that, you can easily compute either in linear response or, unfortunately, because the experiment went at it with a sledgehammer, you have to go beyond linear response. And this is where having new simulation technique like time-dependent DMRG, which I'm sure you heard in the other workshop, can help you to study this new phenomena, which is really a time-dependent Hamiltonian, where you're really pumping energy in the system and try to understand what is the source of these various peaks. Okay, so why do you get this peak? Relatively easy to understand. Let's assume you're in a Mott phase. You're having one particle per site. Now you make a transition where you put one particle from this site here. You pay an energy of order U. This is one kinetic energy. The other kinetic energy takes you back. And therefore, the first peak here is measuring essentially the gap, the Mott gap, the energy to put two particles on the same site. I let you, as an exercise, if you want, as a question, to determine what the second peak, which is at an energy of the order of 2U, is measuring. Okay, if someone has an idea, you can always ask me the question or ask me to tell it in the questions. Okay, so that's one thing, but okay. We understand that this allows us to probe the excitation spectrum. This is like doing spectroscopy. This is measuring, for a many-body problem, what is the Mott gap in the system. What we could show, for example, with Corinna Collat was that you also get very interesting information on the spectral weight of this peak. If you have fermions with spins, you can deduce the degree of antiferromagnetic order in the system. Why? Because if you have two fermions which are with spin up, which are neighboring, then they cannot jump on one on the top of each other, so this peak will be absent. On the contrary, if they are antiferromagnetically correlated, they can jump on the top of each other, and then this peak will have a lot of spectral weight. So you can extract this type of information. But now, how can you make it better? Measuring the average energy is not something which is useful. But again, people doing cold atom have a lot of flexibility on the system. So one thing which suggested was simply, instead of measuring the absorbed energy, to replace it by a measurement of the number of doubly occupied sites. Now you would say, in any condensed matter system, this is crazy, nobody can see that. But not in cold atoms. In cold atoms, measuring the number of doubly occupied sites is something which is very simple. You take your system, then you raise the lattice very fast, so the occupation of each site cannot change. Then you change the interaction from repulsive to very attractive. You form molecules if two particles were on the same site. And then you measure the spectroscopic signal of the molecule and you count the molecules. So this is one example which is very interesting because it shows that by using the specificity of the cold atom systems, one can modify the probe that was the sort of natural thing to try to get essentially the same physical information. But what did we gain? We gain the fact that measuring the number of doubly occupied sites can be done with a high accuracy, which means now the experiment can be done in the linear response regime, which means for theorists, we can now compute in the linear response regime and get sort of more powerful ways of doing the calculation. So I think it's one nice example where really it started from the experiment, sort of went in the theory ballpark, got perfected by theorists, went back to the experimentalist, and now perhaps can give us, in fact, it was used by the group of Tillmann Esslinger to probe for the mod physics with fermions, and now can give us informations and comparison with the experiment that we could not have done before. Just to finish this story on the shaking, recently with a postdoc, Akiyuki Tokuno, we looked at what happened if you do horizontal shaking. If you shake the lattice, not vertically by changing the amplitude, but just by shifting the lattice. And there, instead of measuring the kinetic energy, what you measure is the current-current correlation. In a way, when you shake the lattice like this, you're inducing a current in the system. So now we are really getting a probe which is the equivalent of the optical conductivity in condensed matter. So one can, again, perfect a little bit the existing probe and try to access quantities which allow direct comparison with condensed matter results. Okay, I think my time is nearly up. I would just like to finish with one thing which is really in the making, so I will not say too much about it, but I just want to mention it. I said we are doing spectroscopy, and that's essentially the chapter two. I would like to end up with chapter three, which is microscopy. And I think this is something which is very important and which is probably something that will explode in the recent years. Why? I try to advocate here that we want to understand the local physics. It doesn't matter. We have 10,000 atoms here, and if we could observe just there, the fact that we get the inhomogeneities would not be a major problem. The problem is that all the probes I told you before are global probes. They average over the system. So people started to develop recently, and there are various techniques that have been developed. There is the group of Marcus Greiner, in particular, at Harvard, and the group of Emmanuel Bloch, who have developed a microscope, really an optical microscope, which allows to access essentially single sites. In other words, they can really look at a lattice and tell you on a single site whether you get an atom or not. So this allows to get rid potentially of the inhomogeneities. You can really focus. Well, I'm slightly cheating. They don't tell you if you have one atom or not. They tell you if you have an even or an odd number of atoms. So I think there is still some work to do for the theorist to have to understand how to take into account the possibilities to have two, three, and so on. But I'm sure this is something that will be sorted out in the recent years. We also have looked at a couple of years ago, together with Corinna Collat and Michael Curl, at the possibility to do an STM by using a mixture of atoms in Bose-Einstein condensate. So you have the atoms here, but manipulating a single ion, because a single ion can be manipulated with a magnetic trap. And people have used, like people like Rainer Blatt, for example, in Innsbruck, use them to obtain qubits and do quantum information. But you can also use the ion as a kind of probe that you will put on the top of a site, and then using microwave signal, bind with one particular atom. So the same way that an STM allows you both to probe a surface and also to manipulate atoms, we can imagine with more complex system of condensate and ions to be able to manipulate locally some properties in Bose-Einstein condensate. This is in the making. I mean, Michael has a very nice paper in Nature where he realized this type of system. The resolution is not yet there, but I think these three probes are an example on how fast the field is developing and how well one can, I hope very soon, resolve this problem of inhomogeneities and perhaps reach this goal of quantum simulating in an extremely efficient and powerful way. So I think it's time for me to stop. I took you on this little tour of cold atom physics. I'm sure my colleagues in cold atom wanted to probably to kill me at the beginning of the talk after I said all the limitations of cold atoms. I should ask for political asylum in Switzerland in a couple of weeks. But I think, again, the message is that this field is evolving at an incredible speed, and all these challenges that are provided by the experiment are a source of inspiration for new techniques that, as I said, give us new window on very interesting phenomena. And on that, I stop, and I thank you for your attention.
Any questions?
We are very proud of you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm voiceless.
So why actually are you measuring this response function? Because the response you measure is the energy.
This one?
Yeah, because you should find a combination of the Hubbard and Hamiltonian.
Yes. So, okay. So you have the Hamiltonian H0 plus H kinetic plus, let me call it delta T or delta J. It's like telephone plugs. We need to normalize the notations. People in cold atoms call the kinetic energy J, which caused considerable confusion with the antiferromagnetic exchange, but that's another story. So this is what you get. You get H0 plus H-kin plus a modification of H-kin, and you're right, you would get also a delta, whatever, delta U-H interaction or something like this. Okay, the sum of the two is nothing but the total Hamiltonian. If you make a modification of the total Hamiltonian, it doesn't change the energy absorbed. So you can, in fact, subtract this part from the previous one and then do linear response just in the kinetic energy. And in fact, this is important to do. We are at the moment playing with experiments which are done in Tillmann Esslinger's group. If you don't do this correction, you don't get good agreement with the experiment. But at the end of the day, everything can be reduced to this correlation. The rest is a modification of the total Hamiltonian and doesn't change the energy absorbed.
Okay.
Everybody is voiceless. Thank you.